Here we are at the end of another year, and what better way to end the year than with a nice drink? That's what people do at the end of the year, right?
I've read that.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot of people do that. Some people give it as gifts for the holidays, too.
Oh, wait. Do you guys have something for me? Is that what this is?
Oh, just you wait. So we realize, like, distilleries are just booming in Northern Illinois.
I haven't seen this many distilleries since, like, the 1920s popping up.
Wow. And those weren't even legal.
But they were everywhere,
yeah,
I'm told.
It's true. So now we've got legal ones. And we decided to pop over to the one that's, you know, nice and close to the station even, Whiskey Acres in DeKalb.
In case we tried something, you didn't have to drive back too far.
Well, we could walk if we had to.
Exactly, which yes. We did, maybe.
Or yeah. We had a designated driver, which, you know, we'll give you maybe a little special recipe for that.
Theoretically.
Oh. Coming up a little later in the program.
Yeah, you got to stick around to the end for that.
Yeah.
But we got to talk with Jamie, the CEO over there at Whiskey Acres, and he told us a little bit about their history and a little bit about the history of whiskey, which was super interesting to hear. A lot of stuff I didn't know, everything from the history of the barrels to maybe the Secret Service using Whiskey Acres products.
Hey, don't give it all away.
Okay.
Jamie Walter from the Walter family that runs Whiskey Acres.
Let's get into it.
My name is Jamie Walter. I'm president and CEO at Whiskey Acres, also co-founder and one of the resident farmers. So we grow primarily corn and soybeans, have been for a number of years. I'm actually a fifth generation farmer. One of the things that makes Whiskey Acres very unique in the distilling world is we're one of the few estate distilleries. So that means that we grow all the feedstock that's used in the facility. So whether it's corn, wheat, rye, barley, it's all grown by us right here on the property and then distilled and aged and then eventually bottled.
So can you take us through, like, the life of a kernel of corn that ends up, from the time it goes in the ground to the time it goes into my stomach, how long does that take?
Yeah, so those kernels of corn are actually ordered right about now, in the kind of the December time frame. I am planning next year's crop, right? So I'm purchasing seeds that we're going to plant in the spring. Those seeds will be planted in April, May of next year. The growing season then takes place all through, you know, the summer. And then next fall, we'll be harvesting those grains. Then we put them in storage here at the distillery. And over that next year, we'll begin distilling them. We distill that grain, and then we lock it up in a barrel of whiskey for an additional 4 to 7 years, typically. Most of it's probably 5 or more years. So it's, as you can see, a really long, drawn-out process. Really, from start to finish, for us to make a barrel of whiskey, typically takes somewhere in the 6 to 8 year range.
Okay.
When you've got a grain, what grain becomes what? What does corn become?
So it depends on what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So in general, in agriculture, number 2 yellow dent is the type of corn that's raised in the DeKalb area and most of the Midwest or the Corn Belt.
That's like feed corn then?
Yeah, exactly. So typically most of that grain is being raised for animal feed. It could be for human consumption, for corn syrups, starches, etc. Or increasingly a lot of it is used for fuel ethanol. Hmm. But ultimately, in distilling, it's also used as ethanol to make whiskey. I mean, that's effectively what we're drinking is ethanol when we make whiskey. So the grain that's grown around here is used for one of those purposes. At Whiskey Acres and our farming operation, roughly 10% of the grain that we grow is actually used in the distillery. The other 90% is still sold elsewhere. So we export some of it. Some of it's used for fuel, ethanol, etc.
It's okay. Funny to think that there's a kind of a crossroads where it can either become fuel or become
right.
Whiskey.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I was wondering, like, with so wheat, you're growing wheat. What does wheat, does it something besides whiskey?
The wheat that we're using in the distillery is fermented and is used for making whiskey. Again, though, some of that wheat that we grow, we will sell elsewhere, and most of that is going into in the local market. Most of it's going in down to Mendota, and there's a flour facility there. We make different types of whiskey. So, what is whiskey? Whiskey is a distilled spirit made from fermented grain. Okay. Then you have different types of whiskeys. So, for example, rye whiskey must contain at least 51% rye. Wheat whiskey, 51% or more wheat. Bourbon is a little bit of a unique animal because bourbon also must contain a minimum of 51% corn. But unique to bourbon is that it can only be made in the United States. So under international trade rules, yeah, bourbon is a product of the United States, not Kentucky. Bourbon bourbon is a product of the United States. In fact, while our friends in Kentucky like to claim that they're the home of bourbon, actually Illinois is. Prior to Prohibition, Peoria was the center of bourbon production. There were over 75 distilleries in Peoria before Prohibition.
So it's before Prohibition. I thought bourbon was a Prohibition kind of.
No, it was actually made prior to Prohibition.
I did not know that about Peoria too. That's interesting.
Yeah. One thing that you do is do specialties, which I want to know more about too. Because yeah, you know, you've got your great basic stuff, but then what is a specialty whiskey or bourbon or whatever?
Sure. So in your let me start with the base stuff, right? Okay. So we use that regular number 2 Yellow Dent, of which we've done research and we found certain varieties of commercially available Yellow Dent actually make superior flavored whiskey. So we concentrate on 3 or 4 commercial Yellow Dent varieties to make our straight products, our straight bourbon, as well as our bottled and bond bourbon. Now, as we go forward and as we've done additional research, we've created an entirely new line here at Whiskey Acres called our Artisan Series. And our Artisan Series generally is made from corns that are heirloom or specialty grains. And they're very unique in the industry. We're one of the only distilleries in the world to do this. In fact, just last weekend, we released our Blue Popcorn Bourbon. It's exceptionally popular. One of the big whiskey judges in the United States, Fred Minnick, rated our Blue Popcorn as among the top 3 craft bourbons in the entire United States. Nice. So it's already sold out. We release it once a year. It goes very fast, but we're very proud of that. So we make a Blue Popcorn, a Glass Gem, a Green Oaxacan, which is a green corn that originated in Oaxaca, Mexico. We grow that here now. We've even bred our own proprietary variety of corn that crosses 2 heirlooms. And one of them's from Italy, one of them's from the U.S. that was used to make whiskey during Prohibition, and we've crossed those and are in the process of receiving a patent on that right now.
What happens once you go through the process? I imagine there's some sludge or something left over from that corn and stuff like that. Do you guys have a sort of a thing that you do with it?
Yeah, we recycle as many of our inputs as possible. So in the case of the spent grain, we have spent grain that's left over after the fermentation and distillation process. It goes into one of 2 channels. Either it's fed to livestock, there is feed value in it. However, it's very wet, almost soupy, and it can be a little difficult for livestock feeders to handle and just incorporate it into their feed ration. So if there's not a feeder that's currently utilizing that product, it also has fertility value. Think of it as compost. And so we will spread that back on the fields as fertilizer for the next crop. Then the tails also, which is kind of the oils and the water that's left over from the distillation process, some fertility value, some nitrogen, also spread back on the fields. And believe it or not, the heads, that's the highly volatile alcohol products that aren't ethanol. Think methanol, acetone. These chemicals are poisonous to humans, but they're a type of alcohol. They have a very low freezing point. And so we donate those to the highway department, and they blend those with salt to make a brine, and they treat the roads locally to help ice control in the winter time.
Oh, wow. So the corn that you grow could be used for fuel for a car, could be fuel the person, but probably not at the same time while they're driving.
Yeah,
but
then
also
not so much,
keeps the roads clear. It's
keeps
really
it from sliding into the cornfield.
Yeah.
Everything is pretty well recycled here. You know, our cardboard, our glass, all goes into recycling programs. The grain after we harvest it, you know, the plants themselves are all composted back into the fields as fertilizer. You know, some of our corn's used to make fuel. I mean, it's very much a cyclical lifestyle that we live here. The other thing that's kind of unique, we take sustainability very seriously. We were one of the first distilleries in the United States to put in a solar field that powers 100% of the electrical needs of the farm and distillery. So that went in 2018. So over the next couple of years, we will be one of the larger solar producers in Illinois. And actually, we will produce enough electricity here to power the entire city of DeKalb.
Oh. Yeah,
just to sort of take us back, I'm just sort of curious about this myself. Like you were farming, I'm guessing you were corn and stuff like that, and then at some point you said, "I'd like to open a distillery." Like, yeah, what was the reception?
Yeah,
like
it was a little bit of a left hand turn, right? So a little bit of the backstory. My grandfather Joseph started this farm here in the Depression era in the 1930s. My dad and several uncles farmed here together. I actually went off to school, became a lawyer. Returned to the area and practiced law for a brief time in the late 90s and was kind of dissatisfied with my career choice. And so I had an opportunity to buy an uncle out that was retiring from the farm, and I did so in 2000 and joined my dad farming. So we've been farming together since then. And along the way, I've always been a bit of an entrepreneur. We got involved in the seed industry and crop insurance industry, various additional businesses. And my dad and I always had an interest in doing something of higher value. Instead of just making a commodity that is just sold into the open market, why not take advantage of our proximity to Chicago and start making a consumer product that could go direct to consumers? And we actually looked at different things. Popcorn was one, bakery goods was another. But in 2012, 13, I started really researching spirits and decided that, you know, what's DeKalb if not the Napa Valley of corn, right? So instead of making wine, let's make bourbon. And since bourbon has to be a minimum of 51% corn, it seemed like a great place to grow corn for that. So we put a business plan together, hired some additional help, hired a consultant named Dave Pickerell. Dave really helped put us on the map. For your listeners, he's kind of the Michael Jordan of the bourbon industry. He's since deceased, but at the time he was retired as the former master distiller at a little place, maybe you've heard of it, called Maker's Mark. Mm-hmm. And we brought him on to teach us everything that he knew about distilling and really kind of helped put us on the map. So that all started in, you know, 13, 14, and we started producing in late 2014.
And you get steady business people coming in here. I remember when, like around, I think 2015, I was on a bike ride with some people, long bike ride, and it started to snow. It was May. And it was before you were open, but we kind of like huddled in here, and then somebody took pity on us and let us in and even let us drink a little bit. I think the registers weren't working yet, but then,
okay.
You know, so we just waited till you were
cool.
So we could pay for everything. But that was really nice of you guys. I want to thank you for that.
Sure. No problem. We'll take refugees when needed. But, we're open to the public on Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays. Our hours are at whiskeyacres.com. You can find out more information, sign up for our newsletter, maybe follow us on social media. All that kind of information is there. But we're in production Monday through Friday. So we're making booze Monday through Friday. And then on the weekends, we open up our facilities to the public. So okay. We receive, on average, about 2,000 visitors a month. On Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's always interesting. We've done a lot of research on our visitors. Roughly 25% are what we would call local. You know, they're from the DeKalb, Sycamore, and surrounding areas. A lot of them come and see us, you know, maybe if not weekly, every few weeks, and enjoy a cocktail at our tasting room, sit by the fire, maybe enjoy some live music. We have food trucks here throughout the year, maybe a little less so during the winter. But they come on a regular basis. Then about 50% of our clientele comes from the Chicago and Chicago suburban market. So we get a lot of people to come out and take a tour, visit, buy a bottle and take it home. Surprising to us is almost 25% of our visitors on any given weekend drive from over 100 miles away. So wow. We get visitors from throughout the Midwest, usually a half a dozen or more different states every weekend, and 2 to 3 foreign countries every weekend.
Wow.
Yeah. This place has become kind of a destination.
And not only is it a destination, we are the number one rated tourist attraction in all of DeKalb.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you've got a sign on the road, too.
Yeah,
and the feeling when you walk in here, the tasting room, it very much feels like it's perfect, like a winter night, and it feels like you're coming into like a log cabin or something with the big fire going.
Not only that, but you probably notice it's also the preferred place to work during the winter time. Most of us take our laptops and set up in front of the fireplace. It makes it like working in your living room.
So it sounds like you approach this as an idea for a business, more like it's not like you were a whiskey connoisseur and you really wanted to make whiskeys. As an amateur, somebody just likes to drink. What am I looking for when I sip at a whiskey, like one of yours or any kind?
Well, let me back up just a hair. My interest in whiskey actually came through the wine industry. Okay. So before we got involved in whiskey, my wife and I and another couple actually had a small, I just call it kind of a side gig, right, making wine in Napa Valley. Don't have time or the breath today to get into all that, but we had some experience buying grapes in California, making wine in California, and then importing it into Illinois. So I came to whiskey from the wine side of the industry. And so when we built Whiskey Acres, much of our attempt was to recreate a winery type experience here on the farm, but with whiskey as the focus. Okay, that's really where we were coming at. So we look at whiskey much like a vintner would look at grapes and making wine. We look at corn in making whiskey. So, you know, we talk a lot about appreciation and depth and complexity when we talk about whiskey. And we focus on quality and not quantity. And so, you know, when we taste whiskeys here, we would approach it somewhat like a wine. You know, I mean, there's an experiential process that goes into tasting whiskey. You know, we're not big on shooters. You know, we're not going to pour a shot glass and slam it down. You know, we would rather pour a small, you know, even a tulip glass or some sort of a whiskey nosing glass, and really first focusing on the nose or the bouquet that we get coming out of that. Then, you know, we'll focus on a small taste where you really try to pick up those notes of caramel and vanilla and the influence of the barrel in appreciating the whiskey. And then obviously on the finish, we like to see the complexities, right? Where can you pick up a little bit of that smoke? Sometimes a little bit of coconut, a little bit of, those are all characteristics of a finely balanced whiskey, and in appreciating it and really taking the time to savor it. That's what we focus on.
If somebody's drinking an old, I've had some pretty wicked old fashions here in this building. So is that like kind of less cool than just drinking it right out of
No, absolutely not. I would say we encourage people to drink whiskey however they damn well please, right?
In whatever quantity.
Yeah, well, within reason. I mean, we want people, of course, to have responsible consumption. But yeah, we want you to open a bottle and not leave it sit on the shelf for a year. You know, we hope you'd enjoy sharing it with your friends and family. Whether that's in a cocktail or neat or with an ice cube. You know, everybody has their own preferred way of enjoying whiskey, and we encourage you to experiment and try new things. And yeah, we'll even sit down and have a whiskey and Coke with you if that's what you really want.
Okay.
How much of the flavor comes from the ingredients and how much comes from the barrel? That's something I'm curious about.
That's a great question. And I'd say, you know, that it's probably got some nuances, and it's probably different maybe from every little distiller. But I think, you know, when we worked with Dave and our own experience, I'd say roughly 50% of the flavor comes from the grain. The actual method of distillation, that would be, you know, your water. The still itself imparts certain characteristics. Different stills and different shapes can influence whiskey flavor. So about half comes from the raw materials and the distillation. Then about the other half of the flavor actually comes from the barrel and the aging process. And that's one of the things that is kind of neat to us. Is for most distilleries, they're not growing their own grain. They're not doing it themselves. And so for most of them, you'll hear a lot of focus on the barrel and the aging process, because that's really the only way they can influence the flavor. Whereas for us, we actually control both sides of that. We control the grain side and the ingredients, as well as the method of distillation and the barrel. So while we certainly appreciate the barrel flavor influences that it can add, we probably tend to focus an awful lot on the grain and the distillation process, because that's kind of what makes us different. So sometimes people have told us that you know, we have a very grain-forward whiskey. They can taste the corn. And we always kind of smile and say, good, that's what we're after. You know, we're trying to show off the grain in everything that we do.
Is there anything specific I should be tasting for with a premium whiskey that is not in the, you know, bottom shelf bottle?
I think the way you phrased it in the car is, what's the difference between the bottom and the top?
Yeah, you know, it varies. I would say probably standout differences is if you have a whiskey. I mean, whiskey is generally going to be strong in alcohol, right? I mean, so for most people that aren't into whiskey, I don't care. You could have a Pappy Van Winkle, and you take a solid sip of that, and you're gonna be like, wow, oh. You know, you kind of feel it go down your throat, and it burns a little bit, and there's a lot of alcohol, right? Because typically speaking, you know, we're talking about alcohol ranges between 45, 55, even 60%. I mean, it's a lot of alcohol, so there's gonna be a bit of a burn. But in judging good and bad whiskeys, go beyond that, right? I like to add a little bit of water, maybe an ice cube, help dilute just a little bit, help open the spirit up. It lowers the surface tension of the spirit and allows more of the aromas out. When you smell it, you should smell pleasant things, right? You know, you smell oak, you smell caramel, you smell vanilla, the wood. If you smell something that smells more like acetone or paint thinner, that's a bad whiskey, right?
Yeah, that's most of my experiences.
When you taste it and it reminds you of you know, cinnamon candies, and I don't want to bark at any particular brands out there, but some of those ones that are really hot and cinnamony are actually trying to cover something else up, and so
fiery.
Yeah, maybe fall, something like that, right? But you know, look for those kinds of notes. If it just tastes too off, you want to watch for that. On the contrast side, if it's a little bit softer, a little bit mellower going in, still going to have that alcohol burn. That's still going to be there. But then look for complexities at the end. You know, after you've swallowed the whiskey, after you've breathed a little bit, do you still taste the flavors? What flavors do you know? You know, is it just sharp, or are there some complex notes that you begin to notice, like pepper, especially in rye whiskey? That's a very characteristic trait is like white pepper. And on the bourbons, do you pick up more of the maybe a little bit of leather in some aged whiskeys, the vanilla, even a little bit of coconut? That's a chemical compounds that can be found from the breakdown of the lignins in the barrels themselves. As the cellulose of the wood breaks down, it imparts very interesting complexities and flavors to the whiskey.
Coopers, people who make barrels, how do you find them? It seems like that's an ancient art that now you need to find. Where do you get barrels?
Most of our barrels, actually, we have a partnership with a company in Louisville, Kentucky called Kelvin Cooperage. They make barrels for a number of different companies, including us. Because you're right, the vast majority of barrels come out of the Kentucky region. Our barrels come from there. It's mostly Missouri, Appalachian oak, a little bit sometimes in southern Illinois, but that's where most of our barrels come from. There are other cooperages, and we do run some trials with some. We have some current trials going with some barrels out of West Virginia, out of the Adirondacks up in New York, and we have a very select a handful of barrels on a very interesting project that your listeners might be interested in. You're probably familiar with the Morton Arboretum. The Morton Arboretum here in the Chicago suburbs, we have a number of partnerships with the Morton Arboretum. And one of those is, on occasion, they have a white oak tree. So all of our barrels are made out of white oak. Occasionally, they will have a white oak tree that might need to be removed or maybe got storm damaged or something, and we have rights to that tree to then have it sawn into lumber staves, and then we age that wood, and we have a single handmade Illinois cooperage that we work with that makes a few barrels for us out of that wood. So we have a few barrels in our rickhouse that are Illinois oak trees made with by an Illinois cooper with all Illinois grain and water, and we think it's kind of a fun project to have.
Awesome. Yeah.
So as local as it gets.
I think it's about, I'd have to go look in our database, but probably about 4 years old.
We're getting ready.
It's getting there. And what we're going to do with it, I don't yet know. We have had a number of projects with the Illinois Tourism Board, with the Illinois government. We've been served as the spirit of choice at various governor inaugural balls for some of the speakers events. And so my guess is probably some of those all Illinois things would end up in some sort of project like that.
Can you reuse the barrels?
No. Well, yes and no. So for making bourbon and rye whiskey, both under federal law, barrels are a single-use product. So when we make bourbon or our rye whiskey, which is the vast majority of what we make here, over 90% of what we make is either bourbon or rye, those barrels are single-use for us. So we fill them once, 5, 6, 7 years later, we empty those barrels, and we're done with them. We can't do anything else with them except sell them. And so we do have a used market for our barrels. Our number one market currently is beer. So we work with a number of different Chicagoland and Illinois craft beer manufacturers that buy our used bourbon barrels and then age some very interesting, oftentimes darker stouts, those kinds of things in our barrels. We do have some customers that buy them for landscaping or furniture or some sort of decorative use. But historically, used bourbon barrels went into the Scotch market. And so they would actually go to Scotland and be used to age Scotch. But almost all of our barrels currently are going into the Illinois beverage market.
Well, what's the reason that the brewers can use it, but you guys can't reuse it?
Federal law.
What's the thing about that? Is there any...
It's not like a health issue or anything like that?
Yeah, so no, it's not a health issue. I think... maybe it was political, right?
Okay.
Maybe the barrel lobbyists are really good, but there is a little bit of an interesting history, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but historically, the reason bourbon got its name and why it is what it is you had settlers, right, that came into the United States from Europe. Many of them that had agrarian background settled in the Ohio River Valley and started raising grain. Corn grew best, and so they would grow a lot of corn. And I'm talking like back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. When you harvested that corn, you had to keep it, right? How do you keep it from rotting? Well, traditionally, Europeans would distill it. You know, it concentrates a bulky commodity into a much smaller commodity that didn't spoil.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so they would make whiskey out of it. The whiskey back then that was made was typically what we would call moonshine, right? It was a raw whiskey. It was clear. It was pretty sharp. But what was happening in that Ohio River Valley is you had goods that would come out of the East Coast by boat, come down the Allegheny, the Ohio River, etc. Think consumer goods like nails, pickled pig's feet, salted fish, right? They would go in wooden casks, and they would come down the river, and they would get offloaded in ports like Louisville. And Louisville, at the time, was part of a very large county on the Ohio River called Bourbon County. And then what would happen is these farmers would see all these barrels piling up and go, you know what, we could store our booze in that, right? And so they would buy these barrels to store their whiskey in. Well, can you imagine what a whiskey would taste like out of a barrel that had pickled pig's feet or salted fish, right? So what the farmers did is they would burn the inside of the barrel. They would burn the inside of the barrel to clean it, remove a layer. That would char the inside of the barrel. Then they would put their whiskey in it, put them back on the boat, and it would take now a very slow trip upstream to go back to ports like New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. It would take months and months for that product to eventually get there. And by the time they did, they'd open up these barrels, and instead of being this raw whiskey, it would be brown. It had additional flavor to it, and it would be marked with the port of origin of Bourbon County.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of the history. Eventually, Congress codified that into law, and today, bourbon is a product unique to the United States, and it must be aged in a brand new now, but charred barrel, and that's where it all came from.
So you guys are charring new barrels to make it?
Correct.
This just feels like the most American thing I've heard all year. Yeah. So that was great. I love the history on that.
One of the more interesting things that we did in giving back to the community is, of course, in 2020, right when COVID hit, we actually switched the distillery over to making hand sanitizer. So we were running double shifts. One of those shifts, our night shift, we actually took off of whiskey production and we started making hand sanitizer during that. We were one of the largest manufacturers of hand sanitizer, and we made tens of thousands of gallons of hand sanitizer and sold it all over the country. So we had very large corporate clients, anywhere from, you know, United Airlines and Ace True Value and companies like that. But it enabled us also to continue to donate then in the local market. So we're proud of the fact that we are able to work with our first responders, our hospitals, our nursing homes and schools, and help keep them supplied with what at the time was a very short supply and much needed product. So that was a cool experience for us.
Yeah.
How long does hand sanitizer need to age?
Yeah, no, not long at all. We that was a very exciting and stressful time for everyone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But especially from us. We made 100 gallons of hand sanitizer the first week, and we wondered how we'd get rid of it. 3 weeks later, we were making 1,000 gallons a day.
Wow.
That's incredible.
And was that made with your fine jewel corn, or what did
you
make
it? That was made with Yellow Dent, and okay. It was an exciting process for us. It was something else. We worked directly with Dr. Lisa Freeman from NIU. She helped get some doors opened for us, and actually with our congressman, who at the time was Adam Kinzinger. And eventually we got synced up with Mike Pence's office in D.C. He was in charge of COVID response. And actually we supplied all the hand sanitizer for the United States Secret Service. So during that period, we were supplying 2,000 gallons a week to the United States Secret Service, and they were providing it to the White House and other places. In fact, at the time, we got a little nervous because maybe if you roll back the clock and watch the video, a certain president of ours back then started talking about maybe drinking it. This would be a good idea to clean our. And we thought, oh my goodness, this would be a really bad thing to kill the president. So please don't drink our hand sanitizer. So
it would reflect poorly on the whiskey.
It would. It was, yeah. It was not what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
What are the biggest challenges facing, I guess, maybe your industry or even your business specifically now?
I think right now it's consumer preferences. You know, I mean, consumer demand ebbs and flows for most things. Whiskey is no different than that. The challenge for us is, unlike a typical manufacturer, I can't just make more or less widgets overnight. You know, because of the aging process, mm-hmm. we're forecasting 6-7 years in advance of what consumers are going to want. And so that's probably one of the more challenging things is figuring that piece of the puzzle out. That's one of the reasons I rely pretty heavily on my law degree. They teach you in law school to look ahead pretty well and anticipate various arguments, various things. And I put that to use quite a bit here in the distillery, but that's a trick. I mean, and it's not perfect. It's a difficult science. That's probably the hardest one. The other one, if I'm being completely transparent, alcohol distribution is a complicated process. We have a three-legged stool or a three-tiered system in the United States. So what that means in general is, for most purposes, in order for our products to be sold out in the world, they have to go through a third-party distributor. And that middleman creates a number of challenges for our business that is unique to spirits in general, versus other products. We can only sell directly to consumers when they physically come visit us at our property. Otherwise, it all has to go through alcohol distribution, and there's challenges that comes with that, and every state does it differently.
I noticed that there's like a lot of distilleries that are opening up. They're sort of popping up now more than ever. Are you chummy with other distillers, or do you view them as competition? Like, do you hang out with the Barnstormer people?
It's a pretty collegiate group, to be honest with you. And you know, just like friends, right? You get to know some better than others, just luck of the draw. You know, I mean, we're certainly friendly with all, but we know some better than others. When we were in our formative years in 12, 13 and doing a lot of work and research, we visited a number of craft distilleries, some of them in Illinois, some of them outside of Illinois. And we were always impressed with the generosity of time and information that people gave us. Uh-huh. For example, Blom Brothers in the Galena area, Mike and Matt Blom are good friends. They were very generous with their time and expertise. And, you know, when we offered to pay them something, their comment was, you know, pay it forward. Somebody else helped us. We're helping you. You help the next guy. And we've really tried to do that. So we've worked with a number of distilleries, some of which came to fruition, some of which did not along the way. But it's a good group of people, and we're excited to be a part of it.
Okay.
Well, we're grateful for your time and expertise as well. Thank you so much.
Okay, one more question. Yeah. What's your favorite drink?
Diet Mountain Dew. No.
Mix a little in there or not?
No, my favorite drink when it comes to alcohol or my favorite whiskey, I often tell people I have three children and it's kind of like my kids, you know. Yeah. My favorite depends largely on the day, that probably holds true. Cocktail-wise, you know, it's hard to beat some of those classic cocktails like a bourbon old-fashioned. We have a very popular cocktail here called the Bourbon Slush. We have sold tens of thousands of those, and it was named by the Chicago Tribune as the number one cocktail of summer a number of years ago. We're quite proud of that drink. Right now, just because it's so new, I'm very proud of our new maple bourbon cream. You know, I'm enjoying sipping on that. It's a good holiday sipper. I put it in a similar category to eggnog, though. I wouldn't worry about getting drunk, but I might worry about getting fat if I drank too much of it. So, but it's quite a treat. I'm really enjoying that. Instead of nosing whiskey like wine, where you shove your nose in the glass, we don't recommend that you do that because the alcohol content is so high that it'll go straight up your nose and into your olfactory lobe, and it actually begins to dull in your ability to perceive the different
taste.
Yeah, right. Taste and right and the nose, because your nose and your olfactory plays such an incredibly important role in flavor that you don't want to just overwhelm yourself, right? So instead, what we suggest doing is you waft it, and then you can just kind of keep your mouth open and small breaths, and you can kind of smell that caramel, right? You can smell the oak. And then, since you've got your own glass, another kind of fun thing to do is take your fingers and actually just dip it in the whiskey and rub your fingers together. Notice the viscosity of it. One of the things about our whiskey, it has a very creamy texture to it, right? You can really feel that. Instead of a sharp, squeaky clean, there's a little bit of oil left in our whiskey. It gives it a little bit of an interesting mouthfeel when you go about that, all right? Then take a small taste, not too much. Get used to the heat. Swish it around a little bit. Let it evaporate. Keep your mouth open. Let you just kind of breathe a little bit and get used to that, right? Of course, it's a straight whiskey. This is 100 proof, so it's 50% alcohol. It's going to have a little bit of a burn, a little bit of a sharpness to it. But then as it dissipates, you begin to pick up on some of those other flavors, right? You can smell it again, get used to the aroma again. And if you want to, you can have a little bigger taste. Maybe you've had enough, dump it out, get used to it. What do you smell?
Absolutely getting caramel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of caramel, vanilla.
And there's nothing really right or wrong to what people perceive. Yeah. You know, flavor, scents, there's a human component that differs from person to person, right? You might perceive something that someone else doesn't, and that's fine. That's perfectly okay.
It's been an amazing year. Do we want to look back, retrospective? Like, what was your favorite moment? I was just thinking the other day. In fact, I re-listened to the John Barnhart episode where he talked about his stone collection, his rock collection. Very cool. That was a fun one. What about you guys?
That was a fun one. There was a lot of good stuff this year. We went on a scavenger hunt of Rockford.
I would say that going dragon boating, and you guys were in the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't in the boat.
It's been an awesome year, and this was a fun show too. Over at Whiskey Acres, my mouth was delicious tasting. I
agree with you, Spencer. It was great.
It was great. And one major question I forgot to ask Jamie, though, was what do you have for the designated driver? You know, this was a special request from a one of our coworkers who cannot drink at this point. And so I got a message back from him because I did text or I emailed him about it. And he said, the Shirley Temple
okay.
is what you can drink if you head out to Whiskey Acres and you're not looking for booze.
Is it the same thing as a kitty cocktail?
I think
they're the same thing.
You know the recipe, but.
Looks like you happen to have something here.
I've got the ingredients to make us an end-of-the-year toast.
Oh, nice.
With this. By the way, anyone who wants to be a part of Under Rocks for 2025, how can they get in touch with us?
Just send us an email, rocks@niu.edu. Let us know what you think we should explore in the new year. And let's toast to this. So what's in the Shirley Temple, Sue?
So we've got basically ginger ale and maraschino cherries. So, but to make it extra special, I brought you Detroit's finest ginger ale.
Wow.
Verner's. Okay. Festively overflowing.
So the excitement of Detroit in a can.
You got it. I think I will put the cherries in first. I'm no mixologist, but let's try this.
Now, what kind of cherries are those? Are those expensive $20 a jar cherries?
Signature Select.
Ooh,
jewel.
Yes. Someone at my house really goes through maraschino cherries, and it ain't me. So, yeah, you get a little of that maraschino cherry juice. We'll pop that on at the end. Got a couple cherries in each one. Little Verner's.
Wow, this is so public radio.
That was pleasing in my headphones.
Oh, excellent.
Spencer's mouth is about to taste good again.
Let's go a little extra cherry juice here. All right, shall we
toast?
All right.
Stand up and toast.
Standing up.
2024 was awesome.
It was a great year.
2025?
Here's the 2025. Let's see what we can find under rocks. Ooh.
It burns.